What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Yo, what is going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me what's in the briefcase!
What's in there? Are we going to figure that out on this?
I was wondering how quickly. Are we going to solve this mystery once and for all in this podcast?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm down.
I think so.
All right. I'm Austin Hayden, and I am joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We have Ryan.
Sup, film fans.
And we've got Raymond.
Disco.
And this week, we're going to be talking about a film. It's always so hard to talk about a film that's been talked about to death, but there are endless things that we can discuss. So we're going to bring our own wisecrack, Show Me the Meaning flair to pulp mother effing fiction. All right. I mean, do you need me to say 1994, Quentin Tarantino, John Travolta, Samuel L. Jackson, Harvey Keitel, Uma Thurman, Ving Rhames, Bruce Willis, et cetera. Walken makes an appearance. I mean,
Steve Buscemi, brief cameo.
Keep it coming, Tim Roth.
Paul Calderon.
There we go. Let's just go down the list, okay? It's always tough to talk about a film. I was actually thinking, I actually had a little bit of like ambivalence even going into watching this film for this podcast, because it is like perhaps the most talked about film. I'm going to say this. I think it is probably the most talked about contemporary film, maybe one of the most talked about films ever, definitely the most talked about indie film. And are there good reasons for it? Absolutely. We can talk about what some of those good reasons are. Has the film kind of gone past its sell-by date? Is that something that's possible with the classic of cinema? I don't know. So we're gonna get into all this stuff. But first, before we do that, we're going to get into some first impressions. Let's start with Raymond. What was it like the first time you watched this film? How many times have you revisited this film? What is your history with Pulp Fiction, maybe even Tarantino? And then what was it like watching it this most recent time?
So the first Tarantino movie I saw was actually Kill Bill Volume 1. And it was one of the, I would say probably the movie that kind of sparked the sort of cinephile bug in me. Like a lot of burgeoning film buffs, it didn't take me long to dig into a lot of Tarantino's other work. And this is a movie that I was aware of from a really young age, because my hometown's video store when I was a kid, it had the iconic Uma Thurman poster hanging next to the door. And I remember even then not having any clue what this movie was or what it meant, looking at that poster and just knowing, like, that is for adults. That is surely not for me. Like, that is... I saw this in high school along with, you know, Jackie Brown and Reservoir Dogs when I started digging into his first few films. And my thoughts on it then are pretty much my thoughts on it now. I've probably seen this movie, you know, 8 or 9 times since then, and I can appreciate it. I understand the appeal. It has a lot of surface charm, the snappy dialogue and very slick editing. It's all too cool for school. But this movie has always just left me a little bit cold. I've never really been able to connect with it. Yeah, I've just never really connected with it. I'm not going to argue against its legacy. That would be a fool's errand. You know, this is not only one of the most influential independent films of all time, but one of the most influential movies of all time. You know, it spawned countless knockoffs, and it put Miramax into the stratosphere, and, you know, not only did it create a bunch of knockoffs on screen, it created a bunch of like mini Miramaxes, you know, like New Line launched Fine Line, and October Films popped up in the wake of this, which turned into USA and then turned into Focus Features. Like, this movie single-handedly changed the entire film industry, and it had a huge impact on popular culture writ large. But it just doesn't do it for me. You know, I don't think it's a bad movie, but it just doesn't do it for me. So I'm eager to hear your thoughts on this. Maybe we can chop it up a little bit and kind of hopefully zero in on what keeps this at arm's length for me. But that's all I've got to say.
All right, Ryan.
Very interesting. Starting off with a negative review. Awesome. I'm glad that you're here, Raymond. you know, because usually, obviously, most people just have effusive praise for this film. And I'm one of those people. I think that this is an 11 out of 10. You know, like, this is Tarantino on all cylinders. And I like his most recent output, but I don't know if he'll ever get back to this, you know, level of greatness. You know, there's something special about this movie. It's an enigma, and it's hard to really pinpoint why it works so well, because it shouldn't on paper, because it's all these disjointed stories. It's totally super long, which I would usually complain about, but in this movie, I never am bored for a second. I'm like always into what the next scene is, and especially if you've seen it a million times. I mean, I've lost count of how many times I've seen this movie. It's the ultimate, like, dad movie. I feel like dads love this movie. Me and my dad have a special bond about Pulp Fiction. Like, to me, you know, literally, when me and my dad hang out, we have a 30-minute conversation we've had 30 times in our lives where we just recount every single scene. We're like, oh, and remember this scene, and then the Neil scene, and then, you know, that scene's a classic, and that scene's a classic, and every scene's a classic. And I think that this is a special movie that from a special point in time by a really weird special filmmaker at, you know, in his prime, you know, which is great. Like, he had proved himself with Reservoir Dogs, and the disjointed time thing, I hope we really explore, because I do think that is the key to it being so effective. Obviously, if you play this movie in chronological order, it's a pretty standard, not really that standard, but it's just kind of the stories are just more like what they're based off of, these kind of dime store Pulp Fiction crime things. But the fact that he put them all together in this soup and cut them all up and put each scene where they are in the movie, like, it would be it's a totally different movie if you switched up the scenes. I think he did a masterful job as a young, early 30s filmmaker. Anyway, sorry, I rambled.
Rambling is what we're here for, so this is kind of, and it fits so.
And that's Tarantino's
way. I was going to say, it fits so perfectly if we're going to be talking about Tarantino. Yeah, so I haven't seen this film in like 20 years, right? I mean, like full all the way through. I've, you know, seen bits of it, and I've seen portions of it, and there's a kajillion video essays on it, and I've talked about it to death. So I feel like I'm much more familiar with the film than I actually am than you get when you experience a film in its entirety, right? So, and I think that's part of the reason that I was just a little bit kind of like, I don't know about going into this freaking film and then talking about it. Everybody talks about this film. And here's the thing. The film, it's an 11 out of 10 in terms of it being a good film, but at the same time, I kind of get maybe why Raymond doesn't love it, and I see it. Like, I can see both sides here. Does that make sense? Like, a film can be a really good film, and you can be like, yeah, but it just doesn't hit me, right? Like, I can see that it's magical. I can see that it's transformative, all this other stuff. The first time I saw the film, I just didn't get it. I just was like, oh my God, what did I just encounter? I was like, this is crazy. I was like, this is what a movie is? You know, I was like, oh shit. You know, I was a teenager. So I was like, this is insane. So that was the first time that I saw it. And then since then, it's just been talked about to death. And then I think I just bought the Kool-Aid that I was like, oh, it's just super important, right? Like, if you enjoy independent cinema, if you enjoy cinema, you just have to accept that it's good. So then more recently, I've been kind of critical, doing my own thinking, revisiting what cinema is, what it can do. And, you know, there are critiques of Tarantino, so I've been taking those critiques seriously, about character portrayals, use of violence, exploitation, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, okay, can I take all those things? Now, what does that mean when I go and I sit down and I watch a film? And every single time I watch a Tarantino film, I'm like, okay, that was pretty cool. You know?
Yeah.
Like, no matter what, every single time I'm like,
of course.
I don't know if it's the pacing. I don't know if it's there's a je ne sais quoi maybe that he has in his ability to craft character, dialogue, tension, pace, the way that he brings you in that is really just – it is unparalleled in a lot of ways. There are a lot of knockoffs, and the influence looms large, and it doesn't always live up to what it is that he's doing. He's just got a little bit of a magic recipe. I don't think he's ever made a bad film. He's made films that I don't like as much. I think Hateful Eight is probably my least favorite of the films that he's made, but I don't think it's a bad film. There's still something really unique in as a piece of cinema,
that's the one of his movies that I would argue is a bad movie.
That is a bad movie. Yeah,
I would argue that's just me,
not to derail your thought. Right.
No, yeah, but I think this is really kind of just my point. Even when he makes a miss for me, it's still there's something interesting, right? And that's what I'm more curious about. So on this viewing, I was seduced by the charm, by the slick coolness, by Samuel L. Jackson, by the religious themes, by the philosophical ideas about fate or just pure chance and divine miracle, the strange what the hell is in the briefcase, the absurd over-the-top violence that seemed to come out of nowhere, the postmodern, self-referential, derivative, pastiche nature of this film, it kind of just fucking works in the end. And you can be as grumpy as you want about it, and I don't know what it is, but Pulp Fiction, I think, still, it has a little something-something. So, let's start kind of tearing this apart a little bit, because I think what is most interesting is we got to figure out why it doesn't quite work for him. Like, I feel like I get it, but it still got me in the end. Like, it still got me, you know? So why, what can we do? Let's start peeling back this onion, Raymond. Start just saying things about why it doesn't work for you, and then maybe Ryan and I put some words to it.
I actually think there's something to what does work for me that helps maybe illuminate some of it, which is the casting. Casting's phenomenal. I think that John Travolta and Uma Thurman are wonderful together. You know, no amount of ink has been spared talking about how great their chemistry is in this film. That first sequence really, really works for me. And, you know, the prologue with Tim Roth and Amanda Plummer in the diner is just... it's really snappy and electric, and you're just drawn in from that, you know, that opening title and everything. Every time I watch this movie, during that first 45 minutes or an hour, I'm always thinking to myself, like, yeah, this is going to be the time where this movie really clicks for me. And then it just cuts to, you know, Bruce Willis bitching at his girlfriend for 45 minutes, and then I have to watch two guys clean a car after that. And I'm just out at that point. Although at the end, to bring it back, Samuel L. Jackson's final scene opposite Tim Roth is phenomenal. Just a brilliant, iconic piece of filmmaking. There's not a whole lot amiss there. But I think the thing that just really gets me with this, and maybe I'm just not a huge fan of anthology films in general, but this movie kind of reminds me in some ways of... it may be an apt comparison because Miramax was owned by Disney at this point, but back during World War II, when all the Disney animators were enlisted into the war effort to make propaganda shorts for the military, they didn't have enough manpower on hand to you know, churn out new stories for the theaters, at least not at feature length. So they did essentially anthology films like Make My Music and Melody Time, and all of them are completely disconnected. It's just, you know, a handful of fun shorts that they were able to put together for 60 or 70 minutes to help keep the lights on over in Burbank. And this movie, in a way, kind of feels like that. It feels like a lot of unfinished ideas in a way. And I think that I so enjoy what's happening between John Travolta and Uma Thurman. I'm getting invested in their story. And then I see John Travolta die. And then the stakes are completely gone for me. We maybe talked about this a little bit with Tenet, where it's like, well, you know, it's going back and forth in time. Like, I can't really be invested in what's going to happen to this character that I really love, because I know that he dies on the shitter eventually. Like, I'm not concerned that he's going to die in a big shootout at that diner at the end there. Like, you know, even if those scenes work on a moment-to-moment basis, I'm kind of out of it stakes-wise. And that's not to imply that...
Right, but isn't it because that scene in the diner, that's not his storyline, right? That's Jules' story at that point.
Sure.
And so our allegiances are meant to shift in the three different storylines that we get, right? Which I just realized that I didn't do a freaking synopsis of this film, and we should probably try to freaking encapsulate. I just got so excited to get into it after our thing, but But there's three different storylines, right? And so this is one of the different storylines, and there's three different protagonists in each of those tellings. And so I get what you're saying, but maybe it's because what he's trying to do is, rather than present an anthology film, is he's trying to shift, okay, you see the world from different angles, absurd events happen, now let's get the kind of climax of this from Jules's perspective rather than from Vincent's perspective, which is then supposed to kind of suck us into that. And now maybe why that leaves you a little cold is because that's like, it's ideas first and character second. And maybe that's the issue, right? Because it's style maybe over content here. Is that kind of...
That criticism is often leveraged towards Tarantino, that he's style over substance. And I think sometimes it holds water, you know, maybe in Pulp Fiction. But I think you're kind of furthering my point, which is that I understand that these are multiple storylines and that the sort of focus or the spotlight is shifting between each of the sequences or vignettes. But the thing for me is that I can't help but come away from this film feeling as though each of these are kind of unfinished ideas. You know, the middle story was shaved down from Roger Avery's feature Pandemonium Reigned. Like, that was its own hour and a half long movie that was chopped down into, you know, 40 or 45 minutes to whatever degree it was truncated for this film. Like, the backbone of it still exists, but it's still just one of those things where I feel like there are a lot of leaps that get made in this movie that teeter on the brink of, like, my least favorite thing in movies and screenwriting, which is, and then this happens, and then this happens, which is that there is a lot of cause and effect. Much of the script is plotted out in a very causal way. I like everything in the Bruce Willis story for the most part until they just so happen to butt into the one store that happens to be run by the guys from Deliverance. Like, it's stuff like that that just... And I know that there may be something he's doing there to contribute to the sense that this entire universe is just bent and like, corrupted in some ways. But for the most part, it feels Pulp. Like a, you know, pretty... What's that? Yeah, exactly.
Pulp.
But as soon as like the gimp gets out of the box, I'm just like, oh my god, this movie's so fucking stupid, and I'm just totally out of it. And that to me is one of those things where like, I know, but just to let me put a button on this. I know that this entire movie exists in an elevated reality, so I know it's not too much of a departure. But the rest of the movie feels relatively grounded compared to that sequence where it's just like, and now man dog from box comes out, and that I think is the part of the movie where I'm just completely out of it. It's just one of those like you kind of mentioned in your opening statement, Austin, or alluded to, that this movie is about how things just happen and things kind of collide, and that like the existential degree to which we could talk about this is just, you know, the universe is random and uncaring and unfocused, and there is no narrative structure to it. Maybe that's what he's driving at, but for me it just doesn't connect. But I apologize. I'll sit out the next few minutes.
No.
I think that a lot of the reasons that you don't like this movie are reasons that I like the movie.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Kind of part of it, or that make it good. Like, you had said it's like kind of an anthology movie that seems like a bunch of disjointed parts that are kind of half baked. I hate anthology movies as a genre, because I think just the collections of short stories, it's just like they should be their own thing. And it is the disjointed, that they're not connected, reason that I don't like it. But to me, this is a great example of it. They are different storylines, but it feels like one whole story. It feels like one story with three stories to it, to me. It feels like a universe like that. And you had just alluded to something else that has this existential, you know, colliding effect of the storylines. And I do think that is kind of what he's going for. That is part of the theme of the movie is chance, the randomness of life, you know, like that they could have gotten shot. And what does that mean? Like, was that a random thing or was it God? You have two different ideologies of that. The guy who thinks it's random gets shot on a toilet at the end. The guy who thinks it's God is presumably roaming the earth like Cain and Abel, you know, and living
or
a different
Cain
kind of
Kung Fu.
Monastic life. Yeah, Cain from Kung Fu. That's what I meant. Anyway, so I like that about it. And also I like the fact that the style of the film is that it's very much like a day in the life of these gangsters. Like it's the parts of the movies you don't usually see. It's them talking about cheeseburgers on the way to go kill somebody, which isn't usually in the movie. You usually are just get a montage of them going to their hit. They're in and out, and you get the action. This is all the parts you don't normally see, which I think is a big part of this film. And also, what we should talk about is just the fact that Tarantino, I think his special sauce that you had kind of alluded to, Austin, is that his intention for movies is he's literally thinking of the audience every step of the way and what an audience wants to feel at every moment. He's taking you on a roller coaster ride, whereas a lot of filmmakers, I think, are trying to tell their story, their vanity story, and then, oh, how do I make this entertaining? He's thinking about entertainment first, which is, to me, what I love about him. But he's doing it in such a bizarre way with these different kind of seemingly random stories, you know, the him getting shot, Marvin getting shot in the head and stuff, which just comes out of nowhere. Like, he knows how to twist your buttons as an audience. And that's why I think his movies are so unique and weird.
Yeah, there is a strange, because, okay, let's take a normal hitman sequence, right? Like, you get two hitmen, they're going to go, they've got a job, we're introduced to them in the car. There's probably, like, ominous music. Maybe they're talking about how, like, they got a certain amount of time. If they don't get this job done, then Frankie, the boss, is going to come after them. And just like one of them fucked up last time, one of them's the junior and one of them's the senior, right? And they set up this tension, and it's like a super suspenseful car ride over. They get there. It's slick. It's cool. Like, that's not any more quote-unquote real at all, right? We're still all living in the world of fiction and creation and imagination here. The thing that's kind of interesting is that he adds, in a way, a type of humanity. Not that the other version, that the hitman version that I just gave, that's like the stereotypical one, isn't a type of human experience. Everything within cinema is human, right? It's just to what degree of abstraction or what kind of like stylization is it? So he just adds a different type of stylized humanity. And it's the like the absurd part of humanity where people have foot fetishes and love to give foot massages, or where people are like, oh, let's talk about a fucking burger and like how different countries name this same thing different things and how that's kind of interesting. You're brought into like what? International
things just happen in life.
yeah. And so there is a type of humanity that is kind of brought into this that is interesting, which is weird because people don't really talk about Tarantino as being a human filmmaker. They talk about the style over the substance, or the form over the content, as though he somehow isn't like thoroughly concerned with humanity. But I think this is the issue. And Ryan, you just kind of like hinted at this. It's because he's always thinking about how can I entice the audience, or how can I trick the audience, or how can I hold them in suspense. And I think it's because he's always somehow thinking, ooh, wouldn't it be cool if people talked like this? Or man, when I see this type of really stylized dialogue, I find it really fascinating. Wouldn't it be fun to have these hitmen talking about a burger on their way to killing somebody? And it's that juxtaposition of images. And I wonder if there's something that kind of, it's a humanity, it's a type of humanity, but it's just a really sort of absurd humanity.
I think that certainly humanizes them much to the same degree that the Reservoir Dogs opening scene does, where they're talking about Madonna and, you know. The thing I want to push back on a little bit is that I agree with you, Austin, that I don't think he gets enough credit for the warmth and humanity in some of his films, and in places where you don't really anticipate it. I think a perfect example from Reservoir Dogs is the relationship between Harvey Keitel and Tim Roth. I think that's really beautifully nuanced character work that he's doing with them. And you get shades of that in the first segment of this film between Uma Thurman and John Travolta. Obviously, there's a bit more at stake because this is his boss's wife, and if anything happens to her, he's probably going to get killed. But by the time the third one rolls around, they're totally unfazed about having just blown the head off of their friend. You know, and like, I know that they're familiar with death, but it is one of those things that I think I know it's being played for laughs, and you know, it's shocking and it's fun in its own way. But I think it
does. When are they unfazed?
I think they're essentially unfazed when John Travolta turns around and says to Samuel L. Jackson, he goes, "I just shot Marvin in the face," and he's like, "You what?" Blah blah blah. Like Samuel L. Jackson gets upset about it, but the rest of the movie is not about them, you know, processing having shot Marvin in the face. It's about them cleaning Marvin's blood out of a car before they get into trouble, right? So
they're jaded gangsters.
No, I understand that. I've made, you know, I've kind of allowed for that in this argument. But what I'm saying is that there is, like, I understand that lack of humanity is played for comedic effect. But it is one of those things that I think undercuts the sincerity of the first sequence, because you get the feeling that he's legitimately invested in this woman beyond, like, any sort of libidinal desire or his own professional, like, necessity.
Yeah, but I was going to say, don't you think it's safe? Because it's the boss's girl?
No, I don't think so. I think he genuinely has a connection with Uma Thurman and that stuff. And maybe I'm just reading into that because the performances are so strong. But I think there's something there beyond his own self-preservation or, you know, his maybe crush on her. Like, it seems like there's real human emotion coming out when he bursts into Lance's house and is yelling, like, "Get the fucking shot! What's wrong with you?" Like, there's urgency, there's stakes, and I think that is driven as much by his feelings for Mia as it is out of his own sense of self-preservation. And I think that ending sequence where everything is just about, like, well, we got to scrub some brains out of this, and they're just, like, making jokes about it and stuff, you know, I'm not saying that they have to be, like, weepy about it or, you know, really, like, upset with themselves or whatever, but, like, recognize that that does undercut the humanity that's in the first act of the movie.
See, I would totally disagree with what you just said. I think that it was totally self-preservation on his part. Like he, that is the game they're playing in that whole thing is, oh shit, this is the boss's daughter. And if anything happens to her, I am fucked. Like, literally, I'm going to get thrown off into the glass, you know, off the balcony or whatever, like the story of that other,
like,
dude,
Tony Rocky.
And yeah, Tony Rocky Horror. So I do think obviously there's, like, they're having that whole flirtatious vibe of the date. But once the drug thing happens, it's like now it's like they've gone through a car wreck together, and that's the relationship. We've just, holy shit, I saw my life flash before my eyes because of, if you die, I'm dead. And, you know, we've kind of have this bond now. And to me, that's not like him being, as you guys said, like shown the humanity to where what happens later with Marvin undercuts it. To me, that, you know, this movie is a comedy. This is like a straight up slapstick comedy in weird ways. Like, if you think about it, and I think the Marvin thing plays into that too, that basically there you get the very hardened guys that don't give a shit about this guy they just killed. And they're just worried about the car they have to destroy now. And yeah, they never talk about Marvin again. I think to me, it's not a tonal shift that bothers me. And especially like what you were talking about with the Gimp scene. Yeah, because once you get to the Gimp scene, you have to be like, wait, this movie started so normal, and now here we are, what is going on 2.5 hours into this movie? And I think that is a bull, like just Tarantino saying, all right, this is a wild ride, and we're not fucking around.
So, okay, this is one of the things I wonder. I was trying to kind of like put my finger on it. Like, why did I have all this ambivalence going into this film? Okay, let's talk about some Titanic filmmakers for a second. So you've got Spielberg. James Cameron. Yeah, literally a Titanic filmmaker. ba-dum-ching. Yeah, good one there. But yeah, so you've got Spielberg, you've got Coppola, you've got Cameron, you've got, and then I even was thinking about like the great auteurs of French New Wave, like Truffaut and Godard, and we could talk about Italian. Yeah. Okay. So we've got these names that kind of they stand above their films, but for some reason, a Tarantino film always feels like a Tarantino film, whereas a Spielberg film feels like a Spielberg film. I feel like I can separate. I feel like I can see the craftsmanship of a Spielberg film and I can admire it, but I still feel like I'm given a story first. With Tarantino, I feel like I was brought into a child's workshop or a man's workshop, and what I'm seeing is this person more than I'm seeing the story. And I wonder if this makes sense to you, and if this might also be one of the reasons why Raymond is kind of like, because what that can do then is it isn't about story first. It isn't about character. It isn't about the emotion on screen. It's more about this is just like a visual plaything. Do you think that kind of – does that make sense?
I see what you're coming from, and I think it veers – I'm maybe perilously close to the style over substance argument. You know, no one's going to deny that Tarantino has a very specific aesthetic sort of, you know, style. And I get what you're saying. That I remember reading an interview with Edgar Wright where he said that the first step of writing any screenplay for him is that he will imagine the trailer that he wants to cut. And everything that he wants to do in the trailer, all the cool little moments and all the funny lines, and he will write down all those things, and then he will figure out a story that he can weave through those things. And everybody's process is different. So I do understand where you're coming from, and it sparked that in my mind, because I can see how, you know, when Tarantino absconded to Amsterdam to write this movie, it was as much his, like, his travelogue, you know, all the stuff that John Travolta sang at the beginning was stuff that he was excited to discover when he got to Amsterdam. And for a while, this was literally, it was germinating in his head as just a straightforward anthology film. And then to his credit, you know, I think the thing that's really revolutionary about this movie, and even to this day, there aren't a lot of anthology films that do this, when he started weaving these characters into each other's stories and creating kind of a macro narrative around it, I think that is, you know, that is as much key to this film's success as any of the directing flourishes. Like when, if you read, what's it called? Down and Dirty Pictures, the Peter Biskind book, they talk about when Harvey Weinstein got a copy of this script, he was calling, Lawrence Bender essentially every 45 minutes and saying like, oh my God, John Travolta just died. What the fuck? Is he going to come back? And then it's like, or not John Travolta, but you know, the main character just died. And then he would call back 45 minutes later and be like, what the fuck is going on? This person just died, blah, blah, blah. And then he called back 45 minutes after that and was like, we have to make this. Like, there is something endemic to this narrative that I think is absolutely, you know, 100%. It not 100% because there's some dispute over how much Roger Avery really contributed to this film, but it is absolutely from a singular voice. I think you can say that of all of his movies, with the exception of maybe Reservoir Dogs, considering the fact that City on Fire exists. But it you know, like that's the thing that's so vexing about this. And I mean, I will catch hell for saying this. The chat will probably blow up and tell me I'm an asshole for being cold on Pulp Fiction when my favorite Tarantino movie is Death Proof. But I think there's something about the project of Death Proof where he's making it very obvious that this is a plaything, that this is as much an experiment as it is, like maybe even more so than it is a movie. Whereas this one feels, you know, despite its non-linear narrative and it's playing with storytelling conventions, it still has, like, at its heart, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It just doesn't have them in that order. Like, it's a lot more conventional than I think a lot of people give it credit for, especially when you recognize it as, like, through the framework of, like, this started as just an anthology film, straight up and down. Like, it started as three ideas that, to him, I think there's a tacit admission folded into that, that these three movies were not able to stand up on their own as independent features. Like there wasn't enough meat on the bone for him to turn this into three movies. Like he had to create his own mini universe in order to let these things play out. And I think that's one of the reasons why it always just, it just doesn't do it for me. It feels like a handful of unfinished thoughts that are almost like how Napoleon Dynamite is just a collection of sketches tied together to make money. Like they're very, very funny. And like each individual sketch has its merits and I enjoy it certainly, but like I think that this movie, for, you know, for as much as it revolutionized the industry, and it did, I think is like a lot more simple at its core than people really give it credit for. I think I probably completely missed the point of your question.
No. Yeah, I mean, no, I get what you're saying. I'm trying to figure out what it is. When I see a Tarantino film, When I experience a Tarantino film, I feel like I'm getting more Tarantino and less film. I feel like I'm getting a hobbyist expressing a passion. Whereas when I see an Edgar Wright film, when I see an Andrea Arnold film, I'm trying to think of like auteurs that I love. When I see their films, it's not that I separate them from the craftsmanship. It's that I recognize the piece as being first. Whereas when I see a Tarantino film, I feel like he's first. And I don't know if that's just because he's the kind of character that has become larger than a lot of his films, but it does kind of, I don't know, it kind of like taints my interpretation before I go into the film. I'm like, cool, I'm going to go hang out with Quentin for a couple hours. And whatever his weird fucking obsession is at the moment, that's what he's going to rant at me about. And he's going to tell me some weird story. But I feel like I'm hanging out with Quentin more than I'm seeing a story or a narrative. And I wonder if that creates a strange viewing experience. And I don't know if that's maybe just something that's happened after the fact, too, because he's become like an iconic, legendary type of figure.
I don't know. Oh, no, I mean, he even says in interviews that, like, to your point, when he talks about the soundtracks for his movie, he always says, like, you know, the first thing I do when I write a movie, like, I want to pick out all my favorite records. I put together the soundtrack, and I want to do what I want to do. And my idea for a soundtrack is that I want to make a playlist for every fucking person in the world. Like, these movies are, like, by his own admission, as much just, like, a trip through his head as anything. I think, like, his talking about the soundtracks in those terms, like, these movies are made for him. Like, these movies are 100% made for him and him first. And not necessarily him alone, but I think if I went up to Quentin Tarantino and I said, hey, you know, I'm not too hot on Pulp Fiction, and he asked me, well, what's your favorite movie of mine? And I said, Death Proof, he'd tell me to get the fuck out of here, because to him, that's the worst he'll ever get, you know? Like, so, you know, it's different strokes for different folks, and it kind of depends on the idiom that he's working in, perhaps. Like, I love kung fu movies. I love Kill Bill. I love Inglourious Basterds. I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a masterpiece. I really like Reservoir Dogs. What I'm not too crazy about is the kind of movie that Pulp Fiction created millions of. And I think I had seen so many of those garbage knockoffs that it kind of inured me to the formula. Like, you know...
This might be getting us to the meat of it here. Is it Pulp Fiction, or is it also, like, is it impossible to separate the film from what its effects have produced? And so now when we go back and watch the film, it's kind of like, oh, fuck, you know?
I could see that argument, and I've considered that. But the thing is that I think Reservoir Dogs is in such a similar vein, and I really, really like Reservoir Dogs. So I don't know that, like, that was the first thing that occurred to me, because it's like, Pulp Fiction is everybody's favorite movie. So of course I must be the one who's wrong. Like, I took this burden on myself, you know, right. I've done the research on myself and my own feelings about this. But I mean, I really, really like Reservoir Dogs. Jackie Brown is one of my favorite Tarantino movies. And out of those three, that triptych of LA crime films, this one is the one that it just doesn't hit for me.
Yeah, Austin, the thing that you're talking about, describing, where you're going in and you are getting more Tarantino than movie, as you put it. To me, I wish there was more of that in cinema. To me, that would save movies in a way, because you want, like movie stars, quote unquote, are going away or whatever. So, like, there's not as many bankable stars. And I think that, you know, you have folks like pretty much the only bankable directors nowadays are Tarantino, Christopher Nolan, and that's it. Wes Anderson, you know.
Tarantino and Christopher Nolan are the only two folks who can get the budgets that they get to
command
do
a huge budget.
Absolutely,
yeah.
They're in a league of their own, and
I love getting a lot of Tarantino. I love seeing these movies filtered through his mind and going in, because it's kind of the same thing I want and stuff. I will say, though, that these early films, Pulp Fiction especially, when I see Travolta or Samuel L. Jackson doing these characters, to me, it feels like those are the characters, but it's or those people are the characters. I don't feel Tarantino surging through them like I do in his later movies. And I think that that is a testament to how much it's like been soaked into pop culture. Like his style, his aesthetic of dialogue, just kind of what his movies are. Like that, that I think that when you get on a set of a Tarantino film now, and he would probably disagree with this, but I feel like people are trying to do a Tarantino thing on a Tarantino movie, and it feels Tarantino-y, and therefore, if you kind of, whenever you watch it, like to me, I know you said Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's a masterpiece, and I know a lot of people think like that, but I felt hardcore vibes of just like everybody's just reading a Tarantino script, and it just feels like a Tarantino script being read by actors as opposed to people embodying these characters like Travolta and Samuel Jackson and stuff in like in this film.
These characters are certainly iconic, yeah.
Yeah, I think that his earlier movies, when it was totally fresh, it works better. And then now, I don't know. I commend him for going after different genres and stuff, but it's kind of hit or miss for me. To me, Django Unchained was his last one where I was like, these feel like characters that exist in an exploitation film that, and it's not just like, oh, it feels like somebody trying to, like Woody Allen has that whole thing where everybody in a Woody Allen movie is trying to, it sounds like just Woody Allen talking through their body, basically. Because, you know, and Aaron Sorkin, same way, where it's like, all right, you're just an Aaron Sorkin mouthpiece. Which there's merit to that, but if you're good at it. But I like it when the characters feel real.
Yeah. So what do we think? I mean, I guess we've kind of talked about why the film is successful. Like if we could really nail it down, like why is this film so culturally important? Not like what's good about the film, but why do people gravitate to this film? And it might be for some of the same reasons, but let's talk about this film's impact. Like when this film came on the scene in 1994, why was it like a grenade launched into the cinematic landscape? Like what did it do to alter the course of cinematic history, so to speak, for better or for worse? What did it specifically do?
I mean, if you want to read a whole book about that, like I mentioned it before, Down and Dirty Pictures is a really great book. You know, not only did this movie, like I said, launch a million imitators, it put Miramax on the map in a major way. You know, Harvey Weinstein, may he burn in hell, always said that Miramax was the house that Quentin built. And like I mentioned before, I mean, there were tons of not only Pulp Fiction knockoffs, but there were tons of Miramax knockoffs, whether it was like Fine Line or Sony Pictures Classic. You know, I think MGM launched Samuel Goldwyn in the wake of this, that their sort of indie distribution arm. And there was this entire movement of not only like Pulp Fiction knockoffs, but this notion all of a sudden that, you know, a small movie could do big business. And for the better part of like the 90s, at least post 1994, there were a lot of studios who were chasing, you know, throwing small money in the hopes that it would attract big money. And I mean, that had this seismic effect on the filmic landscape. I mean, not only just individual films, but individual filmmakers. Like, I think Paul Thomas Anderson even says that like his career, he could not have gotten Boogie Nights or maybe even Hard Eight made. I think Hard Eight was 1995, and it's unlikely he could have gotten that movie made if it weren't for the success of Pulp Fiction. David O. Russell is another one. If you read Rebels on the Backlot by Sharon Waxman, they kind of talk about, yeah, it's a really good book. They talk about how the effect of this movie sort of rippled out in the careers of, like, you can see it in the careers of Spike Jones, David O. Russell, Sofia Coppola. You know, just the notion that these movies could find a home and could find financing, I mean, it changed the entire game. Like, we covered Being John Malkovich on this podcast. I don't think there's any way that movie could exist in a world that Pulp Fiction didn't exist, because it was weird and esoteric and another movie that wants to be held at arm's length. And it was made by a weird, esoteric kind of guy. Like, I said at the beginning of this, and, you know, in Pulp Fiction fashion, we're circling back, like, you cannot overstate the effect that this movie had. Like, this movie, I've said it a few times, but its impact on film culture was fucking seismic.
So without oversimplifying, if we say the death of New Hollywood comes with the release of Star Wars and Jaws and the blockbusters and things like that, you know, kind of like the young Hollywood directors and things like that, they kind of like go by the wayside once the blockbuster becomes the thing. Does this then allow a space for a sort of new crop of auteurs to emerge? Is that kind of the idea?
It certainly did. But the problem then, like what happened was, I mean, these movies would have gotten made. Pulp Fiction was made for like $8.3 million. So these movies would have gotten made for less than $10 million at that time. And for a long time, stars would take big pay cuts because they were sick of, you know, watching buildings explode on a green screen or whatever. And they wanted that juicy character role to bite into. They wanted the awards contender. So there were a lot of people who were willing to, you know, quote unquote, slum it in these indies. But then once more and more of these became hits in the wake of Pulp Fiction, stars started saying, like, well, why would I take a pay cut? You're going to end up making fucking $200 million on this. I'm only going to have net points. You're going to movie math that away. And so then a movie like Fight Club that realistically should have cost like $22 million ends up costing like $63 million because Brad Pitt needs to get paid $17.5 million. Like, there is...
So they were too successful.
Yeah, I mean, essentially. I mean, you can also, like, chart the sort of rise and fall of the 90s indie boom alongside the proliferation of multiplexes. Like, when multiplexes first started coming out and there were 12 screens to fill instead of three, like, okay, well, we are only going to have two or three big movies each week, so those other nine screens would be allocated to the Being John Malkoviches of the world. But then theater owners started realizing, well, if we're not pulling a good per screen average on the Being John Malkoviches, then we'll just start programming the new fucking Sylvester Stallone movie on 9 out of our 12 screens. Indie movies got kind of muscled out. They got sloughed off to, like, you know, the video market or television. And then once those ancillary markets dried up at like, you know, the end of the aughts, essentially, that was kind of the nail in the coffin. Like, obviously, there's still an independent ecosystem. You know, I happen to be a lucky, flourishing member of it, but there's just not... You will never have another Quentin Tarantino or another Paul Thomas Anderson who can, A, become a rock star, and B, become, like, rich and famous making movies that, like, are tailored
towards...
Oh, there
will be more of those.
Like, no, I mean... There will never be someone who has their career again who can go from, you know, a $2 million movie with Reservoir Dogs to an $8 million movie with Pulp Fiction to eventually a $100 million movie with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now it's like you're Jordan Volt Roberts. You make a $4 million movie that does well at Sundance, and then you get hired to make Kong Skull Island. Like, there is no middle ground anymore.
The metrics will change. It'll be how many streams did you get? Okay, so then we're going to give you a little bit more resources, and now you're going to get a bigger project. So now you're going to get a series, and now you're going to get a mini series, and it's going to be about building platforms. Now more than, because now we don't have the multiplexes as much as we did before that are central to the cinematic landscape. Now it's more about
streaming services. Yeah. Speaking of Kong Skull Island, you can still see that in rare circumstances, like Adam Wingard's career, where he had a pretty traditional, or what would have been considered traditional in the 90s, kind of stepping stone, where it was like, you know, $750,000 for Your Next after he had done like three no budget movies. Then he was able to do $4 million for The Guest, then like $20 million for Blair Witch. I think he did $60 million for Death Note. And then he did, you know, Kong versus Godzilla, which I thought was a lot of fun. Like, there will always be notable exceptions. And I think you're right, Austin. Like, Death Note was made for Netflix, so the metrics change. And there are places like Netflix where you can still kind of nurture talent slowly because they just need, you know, content. They're not really concerned about opening it here or chasing X demographic. But to answer your question in a very long-winded and discursive way, I apologize.
No, it's great.
The film landscape has experienced several expansions and retractions. You mentioned the sort of the film school brat era. You know, that is probably the closest analog to the Sundance generation. You know, these folks who were able to come up and make intensely personal movies and, you know, then sort of get absorbed into the studio system without losing what makes them them. But that was at a time where there were far more studios and they were making movies in far more expansive budget ranges, in that middle range. Those middle range movies just largely don't exist anymore.
Rye, I'll give you the final word of, and then we'll jump into the mailbag here. What do you think?
Well, I just wanted to touch on, you know, your question originally was why is Pulp Fiction, why was it such a big hit and classic and stuff? And obviously there's a million variables, I think, that come into this movie that all are firing on all cylinders. But one thing for aspiring filmmakers this movie has an amazing ending, right? It goes out with a fucking bang. After 3 hours, almost, two hours and 45 minutes, and you still leave the movie after that long of a movie because the last scene is so fucking awesome that you're like, wow, I want to go tell all my friends that they have to go see that movie. And oh, I forgot, I just was sitting in a chair for 3 hours. And I think he does that with all of his movies. That's why I'm always just amazed at Once Upon a Time, how much people are super fans of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Because to me, that movie is boring as shit for 2 hours. And then it has like one of the best awesome ending scenes ever in a movie, with where you kill all the Manson gang with a flamethrower and you're on acid with Brad Pitt and there's a dog involved. And then boom, you're like, wow, I got to go tell everyone that how awesome that movie was. That was so much fun. I had a great time at the movies. And you don't forget that you watched, you know, 30 minutes of Brad Pitt driving in his car and feeding his dog in a trailer and stuff. And you're like, and that he is so good at ending his films. And so I think that it was the combination of everyone that was classic in Hollywood at the time being involved in Pulp Fiction, the bitchin' soundtrack, the non-linear aspect of the story that was really cool and fresh at the time, and then the kick-ass ending that made you want to go tell all your friends to go watch that movie immediately is the real, like, making it go from a blockbuster to a fucking $500 bazillion mega blockbuster. For an indie movie.
Okay, so then here's the final thing that I'll ask. What Tarantino has said that he's only going to make, what, one more film, right? He previously
That's a joke, too.
Yeah,
he'll make a mini series, and he'll do Kill Bill Volume 3 and say, well, that one doesn't really count. Like, I'm sure he'll do more than one. I think he should stop.
All
with
of the money I have in the world that he makes more than 10 movies.
Okay,
I'm certain he will. But for my money, yeah. I think if he's concerned about having a perfect filmography, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the perfect movie for him to end on. But that's just my 2 cents.
Does he still have gas in the tank is what I wonder. Or
hell yeah, I hope he goes to 20.
Yeah, yeah, like his shtick hasn't run out.
I disagree 100% with his idea that filmmaking is a young person's game, that old people should just sit it out. That's kind of what he's quoted as saying. Totally disagree. I mean,
and the whole death of cinema. Like,
tell George Miller that
he doesn't like digital.
George Miller.
Stuff. Yeah, George Miller.
Max
come on.
Fury Road at 80 years old. Are you shitting me? Like, William Friedkin made Killer Joe and Bug
Hell
in his 80s and stuff. Like, old people, honestly, to me, are some of the most edgy filmmakers we have. Paul Verhoeven's about to make a horny nun movie in his 80s. Are you shitting me?
You know I love, like, Verhoeven.
Yeah, me too, dude. So no, I don't think that you should just quit because you think, oh, the new generation needs to take over. There's room for all of us. I want geriatric filmmakers and the Gen Z times Z plus plus or whatever the fuck we have next to come together.
All right, let's wrap up our discussion about Pulp Fiction right there. And let's just quickly run into the mailbag.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So if you are digging our discussion, or if you are absolutely hating our takes, then please call us and email us and give us your thoughts. You can call us at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807, and you can leave us a voicemail, or you can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. It's movies@wisecrack.co. We're going to look at an email from Jason who had some thoughts/questions on Nomadland, and this will probably be the only one we get to, but we'll get to more in the next episode as well. So Jason writes, I love this podcast and each of you three's respective videos and media careers. My Nomadland thoughts and my ultimate question regard whether Zhao or Malick capture human experiences better. While both directors have huge similarities that you all outlined, I think Zhao goes a step further than improvising her scenes and successfully integrates actual documentary elements into her films, and as such grounds her films in a specific humanity more than Malick's movies do. Her use of real people and their real stories is even more essential to what I think is her best work yet, and my suggestion for a future podcast episode, The Writer. Both directors, they end up, however, crafting a very spiritual and thoughtful tone to their works. When I think of Tree of Life, I picture the kind of big-picture cosmic imagery paired with dreamlike neighborhood streets from my own childhood. But when I think of The Writer in Nomadland, I think a lot more of the protagonist and the people they know and all their interior pains and aspirations. All of Zhao's nature-centric and spiritual elements seem to be in service of a specific human's struggle at the center, and makes me think of her movies about being about these characters, learning their places in their worlds and in the world at large. My question is, do you think there's more that can be communicated about human experiences in Malick's recent tone poem-like approach, or in Zhao's approach? Is it just a matter of individual perspective, taste, or are both directors trying to achieve very different things?
I think I would listen to a podcast from this listener. I think they've got a lot of cool thoughts on the subject. I'll keep my input brief because I love Chloe Zhao and Terrence Malick, and despite their aesthetic similarities, I do think that our listener is hitting on something here, that maybe Malick is more interested in humanity and Chloe Zhao is more interested in humans. But
interesting.
What do you think, Ryan?
I was going to say here in that, I mean, Malick does a fair amount of improvisation with his actors. Like, a lot of it is just finding the film through hanging out with the actors in character while they have
script for To the Wonder. Like, literally no script. He just shot Javier Bardem wandering around, and then he just had him come into the sound booth and read voiceover a few months later.
Yeah, but I will say though that I get what they're saying in the emailer, in the sense that you feel the humanity, quote unquote, more in Chloe's movies, because I think that you are kind of getting, they're more accessible in a way, even though they're both very artistic films. Like, just hanging out with those people and the brisker pace, I would say, than a Terrence Malick film where you can literally hang out, watch, you know, The Planet with Dinosaurs for 20 minutes in the middle of a movie and move on.
Yeah.
Like, he has a very different sensibility. His slow is actually slow, whereas Chloe's slow is slower than your average Marvel movie, but it still has a accessible pace to me.
Definitely his latter work. But I would say, I think Badlands and Days of Heaven are much more Chloe Zhao mode.
That's a mainstream film. Yeah,
Badlands totally is so fucking good.
Yeah, the movie rocks.
All right, so I guess we're not going to be doing Bellatar's Satan Tango anytime soon. Is that what we're saying? Although I would love to do
That was slow.
I want to do Turin Horse because I just want to talk about that movie every day, all the time.
We will see. But no, we will see if Wisecrack lets us do that instead of fucking Army of the Dead or whatever.
Okay, and then real quick, the last thing Jason just said, just a fun question. What would it look like if Malick suddenly signed on to direct a Marvel movie like Chloe Zhao just did? What would the Malick Marvel? Would it be like The Thin Red Line, right?
I think what it would look like is a press release stating that due to creative differences, Terrence Malick has walked out.
Yeah, totally. It would never get made. It would cost $500 billion.
When I saw the trailer that was making the rounds for Phase 4 of Marvel, it was kind of funny. There's this big montage of, like, Marvel stuff, Marvel stuff, Marvel stuff, and then it cuts to woman on a horse, and I was like, yeah, that's from the Eternals. It's like, it's just like a lady on a horse with a sunset behind her. I was like, oh, Chloe Zhao got into the mix. You know, that Eternals trailer dropped. I'm a huge Chloe Zhao fan, so I'll probably see it. But it is just one of those things that comes back to what I alluded to before. You know, I would really love to live in a world where Chloe Zhao doesn't have the economic pressure to go make a Marvel movie, where she can continue to make The Writer and Nomadland and be able to, much like Kelly Reichardt, who's one of my favorite filmmakers, you know, be able to carve out her own sort of career that way. But
she sought them out, though.
Oh, did she now?
I don't know that Chloe Zhao wouldn't be allowed or able to make those things. It's just that when someone comes dangling the bag in front of you and says, hey, this is generational wealth here and career for the rest of your life, and you can keep doing your stuff, it's kind of hard to be like, you know what? I'm going to keep doing my $5 million budget films.
Not everyone is in the position of, like, Edgar Wright to be able to walk away from Ant-Man and go make Baby Driver.
Exactly.
You know? It is... Yeah, who's to say? Like, I have gone on record as not being a huge fan of superhero movies, but if Marvel showed up at my fucking apartment with a dump truck full of money, I'd figure it out.
Dude, cast me. Marvel are filming in Sydney for the next 5 years. Fucking cast me in 2 fucking seconds. Are you kidding? I'm on the phone with my agents all the time. Like, where's the casting call for the next Marvel film? Sign me the F up, okay? Please.
But speaking of recent independent films, I just want to throw out, if you haven't seen I'm Your Woman by Julia Hart, it is kind of the movie that you guys were talking about Pulp Fiction being. It is like what happens in a crime movie when the cameras aren't rolling. And I think it's one of the best movies of last year. Just wanted to plug that.
All right, let's get out of here. Nice. We got to get out of here. Where can people find you on the internet? Ryan.
You can find me at Ryan Shorts on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and all that jazz, and Instagram, Ryan Shorts. Releasing shit all the time.
Yeah, Raymond?
I actually have something else to plug this week. I went over to our friends at When Cinephiles Attack podcast and joined them for a discussion of my favorite Tarantino movie, Death Proof. And that episode just dropped this past Monday. So if you're interested in hearing more of my thoughts about Death Proof, I state my entire case on their podcast. That is When Cinephiles Attack. We've had a couple of them over on our show. For Zack Snyder's Justice League. It was a great conversation. You know, they're great folks, friends of the show. So check them out. That's When Cinephiles Attack.
Sweet. And yep, just search me, Austin Hayden. I'm out there online. I've got podcasts. I do acting. I write books and all that other madness. Come on, man. Send us out, Ryan. Let the people go home.
Goodbye from Los Angeles, California, where Pulp Fiction was filmed.